In all of this discussion, voters and politicians emphatically tell us that race plays no role in their feelings about welfare. But is this true? This is precisely the kind of question that social psychologists have studied for decades. When people say bias plays no role, there are good reasons to believe they are telling pollsters what they believe to be true. They are not saying race is irrelevant when they secretly know it matters. In their hearts, these voters likely feel no racial animus, but that does not tell us what is going on in their hidden brains. What kind of a mental image springs to the minds of these voters when you speak to them about welfare or crime? If race bias plays no role, it ought to be just as likely for white welfare recipients or white criminals to come to mind as black welfare recipients and black criminals. Researchers have conducted a number of experiments along these lines. The basic idea behind the experiments is very simple. You divide a group of white voters at random into two groups and give them campaign materials criticizing welfare, using the race-neutral arguments of the Heritage Foundation. One group, however, hears about the problem through the use of an illustrative white family on welfare. Another hears about the problem through an illustrative black family on welfare. If the debate around welfare is only about personal responsibility, dignity of work, and economic fairness, it should make no difference that one group sees a black family while another group sees a white family. The issue has nothing to do with race, so you would expect there would be just as many people in each of these groups who are persuaded that welfare is, or isn't, a problem. On the other hand, if race is an issue, never explicitly mentioned but a factor in the hidden brain, then the group that hears about the issue through an illustrative black family should end up being more critical of welfare than the group that hears about the problem through an illustrative white family. The same would go for crime. If lowering crime is a race-neutral issue, as it ostensibly ought to be, it ought to make no difference if you make a pitch about the importance of reducing crime to one group of voters using an illustrative black criminal, and a pitch to another group of voters using an illustrative white criminal. Martin Gillens at Princeton University once conducted an experiment along these lines. He asked a number of white Americans about their views on welfare. He then gave them an example of a woman in her 30s who had a 10-year-old child and was on welfare. Gillens told some volunteers, picked at random, that the woman was black, and told others that the woman was white. He asked all the respondents their overall views on welfare. Gillens found that volunteers had about the same level of negativity toward the white welfare mom as toward the black welfare mom, which seemingly supports the Heritage Foundation's argument that opposition to welfare is race-neutral. But Gillens found that negative attitudes toward the black welfare mom played a more powerful role than negative attitudes toward the white welfare mom in driving people's overall views about welfare. Seeing the benefits of welfare accrue to a black woman made volunteers significantly more hostile to welfare as a whole than seeing benefits accrue to a white woman. Gillens also found that volunteers told about a welfare mom whose race was not identified automatically tended to invoke an image of a black woman rather than a white woman, even though there were more whites on welfare than blacks. More African Americans are on welfare as a proportion of the overall black population than is the case with whites. But if I sit a welfare recipient behind a screen and ask you to guess his or her race, it is absolute numbers that count, not ratios. Since there are more whites who receive welfare than blacks, the odds are that the person behind the screen will be white. Why do so many people believe the person will be black? Gillens eventually concluded that unconscious racial attitudes were the single most important determinant of welfare views among his white volunteers. It was not that their opinions about self-reliance and individualism did not matter, they did. But if you took a group of people with the same views about self-reliance, hard work, and personal responsibility, and talked to them about welfare, they were much more likely to automatically visualize a black person than a white person. Thinking about a black person, moreover, prompted many more people to decide they were against welfare in general, because negative opinions about blacks on welfare were more potent than negative opinions about whites on welfare. What does this mean if you are a political strategist or a politician who is hoping, cynically or instinctively, to take advantage of racial bias? It means that all you have to do is talk about welfare in general, and voters' hidden brains will do the rest for you. This does not mean that every politician who expresses a concern about welfare queens is motivated by race bias. The insidious thing is that it is impossible to tell whether a given politician is raising a concern about welfare because of his or her ideological beliefs about self-reliance, or because he or she is trying to exploit racial bias, or both. Short of conducting an experiment, it is similarly impossible to tell if a given voter's views stem from a belief in self-reliance or from racial bias, or both. You can instantly see why this is a potent political tool. Racial appeals can now be embedded in a conversation that ostensibly has nothing to do with race. The same phenomenon is true with crime. George H.W. Bush's use of the Willie Horton ad in the 1988 presidential election is widely credited with his demolition of Democrat Michael Dukakis. Horton was a convicted murderer in Massachusetts who raped and stabbed a Maryland woman while on a weekend furlough. Dukakis, as governor of Massachusetts, inherited the furlough program from a prior governor and eventually shut it down. But Bush painted him as being slow to dismantle the program and therefore soft on crime. Much was made of the ad because it lingered on the image of Horton's black face, and Bush was accused of exploiting racial bias. But the photo was just the icing. It's hardly necessary to show a black man's face to evoke the image of a black criminal in the minds of white voters. All you have to do is talk about crime in general, and their hidden brains will supply a picture of a violent black man. Many other issues work the same way. Everyone can agree that the drug trade has devastated communities, but if talk about drugs unconsciously and automatically evokes an image of black people smoking crack rather than white people snorting cocaine, or if people have greater fears about drug dealers who are black or brown than about drug dealers who are white, you can exploit race bias without ever making a reference to race. Ditto for illegal immigration. If talk of illegal aliens brings a Hispanic person to mind rather than a white immigrant, or if Hispanic illegal immigrants conjure a more threatening and malevolent picture in our minds than white illegal immigrants, you can appeal to race bias without ever mentioning, even to yourself, that the real problem you have with illegal immigration is brown people. The psychologist Robert W. Livingston once told volunteers about a crime in which a Milwaukee woman had been severely injured following an assault by an illegal immigrant. Some volunteers were told the criminal was from Canada and named David Edmonds. Others were told the criminal was from Mexico and named Juan Luis Martinez. Livingston asked his volunteers to play juror and decide on an appropriate prison sentence. The volunteers recommended a longer prison sentence for the Mexican, even though both fictional illegal immigrants had committed exactly the same crime. Once people's attitudes are influenced by bias, even their basic perception of facts can change. In 1982, at a time when Ronald Reagan was drumming up concerns about welfare, a CBS New York Times survey asked people this question: of all the people who are poor in this country, are more of them black or are more of them white? More than half of all Americans believed there were more poor black people than poor white people in the United States. African Americans at the time constituted 28% of Americans who were poor, according to U.S. Census Bureau definitions of poverty. In a more recent survey of Illinois voters some years ago, when the issue of welfare reform was very hot, more than 60% of respondents overestimated, by a factor of 100%, the number of Americans who were on welfare. 1 in 3 volunteers grossly overestimated the number of African Americans on welfare, and 2 in 5 overestimated the size of welfare payments that families received. 90% of the respondents greatly overestimated the amount of the federal budget spent on welfare. The errors were not small. There was not one factual question related to welfare where the majority of respondents got the right answer, or even came close. Americans believed that welfare recipients were more numerous, more lucratively compensated, and more likely to be black than the facts warranted. Those who made the largest errors and believed the most inaccurate facts were often the most confident about the accuracy of their views. It was all the doing of the hidden brain, of course, and a goldmine for politicians willing to exploit such bias. All of us can agree there are issues that are not matters of preference but matters of fact. Mazarine Banerjee once told me, "The reason this is powerful is it shows our minds will not just distort our preferences, but distort facts." I believe that, like bias among Francis Aboud's preschoolers, voters can end up with racial bias in adulthood without ever intending to be biased, without anyone deliberately instilling bias in their hearts, and with everyone trying their utmost not to be biased. I'm not suggesting that political campaigns do not explicitly exploit racial fears by talking about welfare, crime, and illegal immigration. They do. But the reason those campaigns work is that when you talk about those issues, it is minorities who automatically spring to the minds of many voters. Why do so many Americans automatically think of a black criminal or a black welfare recipient when they think about crime and welfare? The fact that disproportionate numbers of African Americans are poor and do get in trouble with the law does not explain why so many people automatically bring blacks to mind during discussions of crime and welfare. As the Illinois survey showed, many people don't merely think more blacks as a proportion of the black population receive welfare than do whites. They overestimate the absolute number of blacks on welfare. If the perception of black poverty and criminality is out of line with the statistical evidence, where does it come from? Part of the answer has been well explored. Media representations of criminals and welfare recipients are often skewed. Media coverage regularly reflects existing stereotypes. The black murderer seems more newsworthy than the white murderer. And the heightened news coverage of certain crimes, in turn, strengthens the stereotype. But I believe there is a more important explanation, and it is rather mundane. As I said at the start, we seek dramatic explanations for dramatic phenomena. Much of the hidden brain's power, however, lies in the fact that its influence is subtle and mundane. Even if media coverage were not biased and the proportion of people on welfare and in trouble with the law were absolutely identical among all ethnic groups, large numbers of Americans would still mentally inflate the number of minorities who are poor or violent, and undercount the number of whites who are poor or violent. Minorities have a disproportionate risk of being linked with negative associations for no better reason than that they are minorities. You can show this in everyday settings that are less emotionally charged than welfare and crime. Divide a group of 100 people into 2 groups, A and B, with 80 of them assigned to Group A and 20 of them assigned to Group B. Make everyone in Group A wear red and everyone in Group B wear blue, so that every person's group membership is visible and easily identifiable. Tell all the people about 10 instances when members of these groups took an unauthorized cookie from the cookie jar. 8 of the cookie stealers were from Group A and 2 from Group B. If you later ask people in Group A to guess the total number of cookie stealers in each group, they are likely to overestimate the number of cookie stealers in Group B and underestimate the number of cookie stealers in Group A. They may even feel that there are a larger number of cookie stealers in Group B than in Group A. When you mention cookie stealing to someone from Group A, a person from Group B can come more readily to mind. People in Group A, in other words, can greatly overestimate the number of cookie stealers in Group B for no better reason than that Group B is smaller than Group A, and everyone belonging to Groups A and B are clearly identifiable. Aberrational things done by people in a highly visible minority group stick up in our minds more dramatically than aberrational things done by members of a majority group. The technical term for this phenomenon is an illusory correlation. If you ask people in Thailand whether Thai men or white male tourists from the United States are more likely to be child molesters, they can easily tell you that there are more American pedophiles than locals. That's because in Thailand, white males are a highly visible minority. Aberrational things that they do will be more memorable to Thai people than aberrational things done by locals. There is experimental evidence to back up what I have just told you. Researchers once divided volunteers into two groups. Both were shown a 15-minute excerpt of a local TV news program. In the middle of the newscast, right after a commercial break, the volunteers saw a story involving a violent crime. The story featured a photograph of a suspect. Without the volunteers' knowledge, researchers digitally altered the complexion of the suspect so that some volunteers saw a suspect who appeared white, while others saw a suspect who appeared black. Every other detail of the crime story remained identical. As with the welfare study, the experiment showed that viewers shown the photo of a black suspect ended up more worried about crime than those shown the photograph of a white suspect. But that was not all. Volunteers shown a white suspect did not associate criminality with whites as a whole, but volunteers shown a black suspect tended to associate criminality with blacks as a whole. Gillens similarly found that his volunteers didn't think that black welfare recipients were lazy. They thought blacks as a whole were lazy. This is how illusory correlations work. When two unusual events take place simultaneously, our hidden brain subtly biases us to see the events as linked, even if they have nothing to do with each other. The consequences of this bias can be gigantic, but the underlying phenomenon is mundane and shows up in innumerable everyday contexts. If you happen to have stomach upsets on two mornings because of something you ate, and you also happen to be catching flights on each of those days, your hidden brain will bias you into believing that flights bring on stomach upsets. If the error were limited to believing that those two flights brought on a bad stomach, it would be one thing. But the bias causes you to believe that all flights bring on stomach upsets. How can we defend against such bias in politics? The troubling thing is that most voters, and perhaps most politicians, do not understand where their attitudes and beliefs and facts come from. At an explicit level, people may talk and think only about issues. They worry about crime, illegal immigration, and drugs. There is nothing biased about this. It is perfectly legitimate to want to see less crime, to want to see immigration laws enforced, and to want to control the abuse and trafficking of narcotics. Critics of tough immigration, drug, and crime policies would be wrong to suggest that these concerns stem entirely from racial bias. In the absence of racial bias, concerns about crime and drugs and illegal immigration would hardly disappear. But race bias prompts people to think differently about these issues, and prompts a few more people in every hundred to adopt stances that they might not have adopted otherwise. It also poisons our ability to honestly debate these issues, or even agree on basic facts. And because appeals to unconscious bias do not have to be spoken about or even thought about deliberately, the manipulation is almost completely immune to refutation. How do you refute something that ostensibly does not exist? When explicit claims about race are made, they can be rebutted. But when blacks are linked with crime, welfare, or drug use only implicitly, such links are less likely to be challenged, Gillens once wrote. Thus, a subterranean discourse on race in U.S. society emerges, based largely on misleading images and chosen to influence voters by inciting fear or indignation. Rarely does one hear public figures make the explicit claim that irresponsible black mothers are the problem with welfare, or that violence-prone black men are the reason our streets are unsafe at night. But since they are not being made, such claims are not refuted. The public is left to draw its own conclusions, based on existing stereotypes and biased media coverage, and the conclusions drawn are exactly what one would expect. A few months before the 2008 presidential elections, the Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, Richard L. Trumka, told colleagues about an encounter he'd had with an old friend in his hometown of Nemacolin, Pennsylvania. The Democratic primary race between Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama was in high gear. "I ran into a woman that I had known for years. She was active in Democratic politics back when I was in grade school, back when Abe Lincoln was born," Trumka joked at a union convention. Then he grew serious. "We got talking, and I asked her if she'd made up her mind who she was supporting, and she said, 'Oh, absolutely, I'm voting for Hillary. There's no way I'd ever vote for Obama.' I said, 'Why is that?' She said, 'He is a Muslim.' I said, 'Actually, he is a Christian just like you and I, but so what if he's a Muslim?' Then she shook her head and said, 'Well, he won't wear that American flag pin on his lapel.' I looked at my lapel and said, 'I don't have one, and by the way, you don't have one on either. But come on, he wears one plenty of times. Besides, it takes more than wearing a flag pin to be patriotic.' She said, 'Well, I don't trust him.' I said, 'Why is that?' And she dropped her voice a bit. She said, 'Because he is black.' And I said, 'Look around this town. Nemacolin's a dying town. There's no jobs here. Our kids are moving away because there is no future here. And here is a man, Barack Obama, who is going to fight for people like us. And you want to tell me that you won't vote for him because of the color of his skin? Are you out of your ever-loving mind, lady?'" Trumka's comments were widely circulated. Polling by unions was finding that Obama's race was playing a role in the minds of many members. "I think race bias does play a role," Karen Ackerman, the research director of the AFL-CIO, told me about a month before the 2008 election. "We see it among union voters and in certain demographics, retirees and veterans, older voters." The Democratic pollster and political consultant Celinda Lake told me she started to worry when polls taken by white pollsters and black pollsters among rank-and-file union members in battleground states started to come back with different answers. White union members told black pollsters they were going to vote for Obama, but told white pollsters that they were going to vote against Obama. Lake feared that many people were hiding their true feelings to black pollsters so as not to appear racist, and expressing their true intentions to white pollsters. Other polls showed that while nearly three-quarters of voters said they would be comfortable voting for a black man, fewer than half thought their neighbors would be comfortable doing so. "I drove to northwestern Pennsylvania about 3 weeks before the 2008 election. The state had emerged as one of the major battlegrounds of the election. Polls showed Republican candidate John McCain struggling, but Democrats and Republicans agreed that if McCain was to thread the needle to victory, he would have to win Pennsylvania. If the Republican was to have any chance in Pennsylvania, he would have to win big in the suburbs and small rural and blue-collar towns such as St. Mary's, which sits at the edge of Appalachia in the northwest part of the state. St. Mary's is part of Pennsylvania's 5th congressional district, which is so sparsely populated that it occupies nearly a quarter of the land area of the entire state. Pennsylvania has 19 congressional districts. The 5th congressional district is overwhelmingly white and strongly Republican. On Brian Nosek's national race bias map, it scores high on racial bias. People from this district who have taken the implicit association race bias test tend to show higher levels of racial bias than about 75% of the congressional districts in the United States. As I drove off the interstate and onto the local roads that led to St. Mary's, I was acutely conscious, in ways I usually do not think about, that I was a person of color. It did not help that, in the matter of a single hour, I got pulled over twice by police cruisers. In the first case, I had pulled to the side of a road to look at a map. When I glanced up, there was a cruiser behind me with lights blazing. The cop gave my car a quick once-over and sent me on my way. In the second case, I was following a couple of slow cars on a two-lane road. I glanced at my speedometer. The cars were going around 45 miles an hour. The speed limit was 55. On a clear stretch of road where passing was permitted, I overtook the vehicles, stepping hard on the gas to get around them as quickly as possible. The cop who pulled me over a few moments later said the cars I had overtaken had been going 65 miles an hour, and that he had tracked me going 10 miles per hour faster than that, 20 miles above the speed limit. I felt rattled. When the cop returned after checking my driving record to give me a speeding ticket, I told him, defensively, that I was an extremely safe driver who had never received a moving violation in nearly 2 decades on the road. "Frankly," he snapped, "that surprises me." I thought about that afterward. The cop had known me barely a minute. In that narrow window, how had he formed a general conclusion about me that would cause him to feel surprise at the 2 decades of accumulated evidence in my driving record? What might have happened if the driving data had not existed and the cop had had only his intuition to guide him? The Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin held a rally in Pennsylvania that same day. Videos taken outside the rally by Obama supporters showed dozens of Republicans yelling comments straight into cameras. "Barack Hussein Obama. Go back to Kenya." And the only difference between Obama and Osama is the BS. The comments might have been isolated and amplified by selective editing, but they did seem to evoke widespread laughter among the all-white crowd. An older man carried a monkey with a headband. "This is little Hussein," the man said, laughing. Others yelled, "Obama bin Laden, go back to Africa," and "Born in Kenya, citizen of Indonesia." Then there was, "We need a Muslim president. If he gets in office, he's not going to have a cross-section of America in his cabinet. It is going to be Al Sharpton, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Jesse Jackson. This isn't an Oprah show." When McCain and Palin were pressed by journalists to address comments made by their supporters at rallies, including occasional recommendations of violence against Obama, the candidates said the comments were restricted to a small minority that in no way spoke for the majority. Union members belonging to the local Communications Workers of America in St. Mary's were canvassing union households the day I visited. I had arranged to walk around town with a 54-year-old organizer named Roseanne Barker, a heavy-set white woman with a square face, short bobbed hair, and an affable attitude. Barker worked for the Northwestern Pennsylvania Area Labor Federation, based in Franklin, and lived outside Erie. She had driven a couple of hours that morning to St. Mary's. Barker told me she didn't think race was a big factor in her part of the state. I also met Rick Zimmerman, the president of local CWA 502 in St. Mary's. He wore a T-shirt and, like nearly every other male union member I met, blue jeans. "I don't see any Obama signs. Maybe people are tearing them down at night," he told me with a grin. "They say St. Mary's is a prejudiced town. We don't have many colored people around here." Barker and I set off to one neighborhood. She had a list of union household addresses and planned to knock on doors and give people her union's views of the candidates. Canvassing is a tiring and generally unrewarding business. There are long stretches of locked doors and impassive faces, interspersed with threatening bulldogs and people who enthusiastically support the candidate you want to see elected. The actual targets of canvassing efforts, people who are undecided or against your candidate, but still amenable to persuasion, are few and far between. I introduced myself as a journalist to every person I met. Linda Emmerett, who was sweeping her driveway with a long broom, told us that she thought all politicians were a bunch of crooks. "I wanted Huckabee," she said, referring to the Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, a favorite with evangelical voters. It felt like he was more in tune with the person who goes out and sweeps the driveway. The others talk down to us. They use words that I sometimes think, "What the H are they talking about?" I think Obama is telling people what he thinks they want to hear. They've got forked tongues. Mark Flasinski, whom I met on the street, said, "I don't think Obama is the answer. I don't think McCain is the answer either, but I think he is the best of two evils." Every person I met who was younger than 40 said they were for Obama. Nearly every person older than 60 said they were undecided or for McCain. Other groups of union members had fanned out across St. Mary's. One voter told union canvasser Terry O'Connor that he thought Obama was a Muslim. Another told O'Connor he was not going to vote for Obama, but was going to vote a straight Democratic ticket for all other offices. "We're in Appalachia, and this is the Bible Belt," O'Connor told me, as if this were sufficient explanation. "The problematic ones are the rural white voters, 50 to 60 and up. We're going to win a lot of them, but open-mindedness is not something they are known for. I don't mind people voting for McCain because of abortion, but not because people think Obama is a Muslim." Gary Bittner, a union organizer who works in 28 of Pennsylvania's western counties, told me as he chain-smoked cigarettes that there was a cultural issue related to Obama. "They're scared of what they don't know. I tell them, what's important to you? Your job? Healthcare? Pension benefits?" Bittner said that Obama's race was often an undertow in conversations. I asked him to give me an example. "It gets said, but not in polite conversation," Bittner replied. "Let's say there is a text message going around saying, Barack Obama will get shot 8 minutes into his presidency. There are people who find that funny." At the American Legion later that day, I engaged an older white man in conversation. His name was Don Jote, and he was 73. He was a lifelong Democrat who always voted a straight party ticket. But he said he was uncomfortable about Obama. I asked him what issues were of concern to him in the election. Jote said the economy and jobs were his principal worries. He said he disliked free trade agreements that were bringing in a flood of cheap imports. As a result of imports from China, Jote told me, the light bulb factory he had worked at for 37 years had seen its workforce shrink from 1,600 employees to 350. "I really don't know which way to go," Jote said. "I've been a Democrat all my life, but I don't know what to think about this election. Tax-wise and everything else, I don't know what to think." I asked him whether he knew which presidential candidate was more in favor of the free trade that he vehemently opposed. Jote said he thought that McCain, who had vocally insisted that he was a much fiercer advocate of free trade than Obama, was more sympathetic to the cause of protectionism. "I'm not sure about Obama," Jote said. "I'm not sure if I can trust him. If Hillary had stayed in the race, I would have voted for her." Zimmerman took me to the home of a colleague, a 68-year-old white woman who had worked at his union for 40 years. The woman came barefoot into her yard to talk to me. We stood below a maple tree as her dog, a cross between a cocker spaniel and a collie, wandered about. Two large flags hung from her porch, an American flag and a Vietnam POW MIA flag. When I talked to her, the woman agreed to be identified, but she called me urgently a day later to request I not mention her name. She said she was born in St. Mary's and had always lived there. She was a lifelong Democrat and despised the Republican candidates in the 2008 election. Among other things, she thought the government had no business telling women what to do with their bodies. She was fiercely pro-choice. She loved everything about Hillary Clinton. But when Obama won the Democratic nomination, she said she could not bring herself to support him. From what I see, the blacks get entries into college and free loans, Latinos too, she said. I am opposed to affirmative action. She told me she had been concerned that if Obama won the presidency, the interests of white people would be cast aside. I was worried I would have to go to the back of the bus. She acknowledged that Obama's race was a concern. But then, she told me, she had a talk with her sister, an Obama supporter. The sister convinced her that Obama would not send white people to the back of the bus. She said she was reluctantly coming around to the idea of voting for Obama. I asked her what her sister had said about Obama that had changed her mind. My sister said, "You don't understand. He is white, too. He has a white mom and white grandparents." That had a lot to do with it. As you can see from these conversations, race bias is never completely implicit or completely explicit. Sometimes it lies beneath the surface. You think it is there, but you can't be certain. Other times, you don't have to think at all. Days before the election, the canvasser Roseanne Barker and I had another conversation. She sounded distressed. A large number of signs had appeared overnight in her residential community. The signs consisted of just four words printed on a small sheet of paper. "Vote right, vote white." Elsewhere, she told me, in a riposte to Obama's "Change You Can Believe In" slogan, signs said, "Change means come help another nigger get elected." Barker's voice choked. She said she had raced around the neighborhood taking down the signs. I didn't think it was so prevalent, but boy, the billboard signs in these laminated pages, it shows that in the rural community I live in, there is a race problem, she said. It is my community, the place where I live. More than 100 of these signs had to be taken down. I never dreamed someone would go to that extent. I knew there was prejudice, but didn't think it was to that extent. The Chicago O'Hare Hilton Hotel is located within the complex of the busiest airport in the United States. From airport terminals, short walkways put you under the 10-story hotel, which has a facade of black metal and tinted glass. On September 27, 2008, one day after the first 2008 presidential debate between Senators John McCain and Barack Obama, a small group of people from all over the United States flew into Chicago for a secret meeting at the airport Hilton. Room 2020 in the west wing of the Hilton had been reserved for the day. On a small plaque affixed outside the room were printed the words, "Center for Social Inclusion." The room's interior was occupied by a large rectangular conference table and a dozen black leather chairs. Through the window, you could see shuttles from the Marriott Hotel and National Car Rental Company sweeping by the passenger arrival areas at the airport. From time to time, red and white trains going between terminals rumbled by in opposite directions on an elevated track. The meeting had been organized on short notice. Barely a week and a half had gone by since the group had informally coalesced through emails and conference calls. The people at the meeting were among the country's foremost thinkers on issues related to bias and politics. When Obama became the first African-American candidate to be nominated by a major political party, these experts decided they wanted to apply what scholars had learned about prejudice to combat bias in the election. From Washington, D.C., came Todd Rogers and Celinda Lake, Democratic Party pollsters and consultants. From Los Angeles came Jerry Kang from the University of California. From New Jersey, Rachel Godsill of Seton Hall Law School. From Atlanta, Drew Weston, a political psychologist and Democratic Party consultant. From Philadelphia, Camille Charles, a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. There were several other community activists, political organizers, and academic researchers. Other experts who could not make it to Chicago called in and participated through a speakerphone. If talk about welfare, illegal immigration, and crime were coded ways to talk about race, Powell wanted to come up with ways to deactivate such bias. The first way, the traditional way, was to uncover the bias. You combat subterranean bias, in other words, by bringing it to the surface. The Obama campaign had chosen a different route. Race was rarely to be made explicit, and the campaign never made a fuss about racism. Even in the face of explicit racism, thousands of people openly said they would never vote for a black man, Obama stayed relentlessly positive. When people hurled racially tinged epithets at Obama at rallies, when some Republican Party leaders openly questioned the biracial candidate's religion, background, and patriotism, when Hillary Clinton publicly declared that Obama's support among working, hard-working Americans, white Americans, is weakening, the campaign responded with the same uplifting messages of unity that Obama had honed since his famous speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. Rather than accuse anyone of racial bias, the campaign preferred to call people to their better angels, to remind Americans that they were above racism. Obama's strategy had been successful. He had won the Democratic nomination. But Powell feared there would come a time when the strategy would no longer work. Powell's team had heard that Republicans were planning a major attack in the late fall, drawing on excerpts from Obama's books where he talked about using drugs as a young man and having devoured Marxist and feminist literature and the speeches of Malcolm X. Powell reached out to the Obama campaign but was met with resistance. "Initially, I tried to get the campaign to do it, and they were of the opinion that it wasn't necessary," Powell told me. "My response is, if you are right, great. But what if you are wrong? You should have something ready. If you don't need it, no sweat. But if you want something and don't have it, you are in trouble." They are not taking advantage of the research in the last 30 years. They think talking about race is necessarily divisive. They don't realize people are very conflicted. Mazarine Banaji called into the Chicago meeting from Harvard. The psychologist had long been a proponent of fighting unconscious bias by dragging it into the open, by making implicit biases visible. But in this situation, she felt Obama was doing the right thing. All politicians, she told me, had to emphasize the bond they had with voters, and it made sense that Obama should stay clear of the subject of race. The bond that a member of a minority group has with most voters cannot be the thing that marks him as a minority. The group discussed different ways in which campaign advertisements have exploited race bias. In the 2006 Senate election in Tennessee, African-American candidate Harold Ford was the target of an ad that played on miscegenation fears. The ad featured a young white woman who claimed to have met Ford at a Playboy party and ended with her seductively whispering, "Harold, call me." One anti-Obama ad showed the candidate's grinning face morph into the face of a wolf. A conservative group linked Obama with Kwame Kilpatrick, the disgraced black mayor of Detroit, who had recently been ejected from office on criminal charges. As the ad listed the various charges against Kilpatrick, it showed footage of Obama standing with Kilpatrick and praising him. The ad advised voters to learn who Obama's friends were. Kilpatrick's skin is much darker than Obama's, and the ad deliberately darkened Kilpatrick's complexion even further to play on the unconscious biases of white voters against dark-skinned black men, according to sociologist Camille Charles at the University of Pennsylvania. Toward the end of the day, I asked the group around the table how Obama might be vulnerable to unconscious bias. Powell, who wore a beard speckled with gray, said that Obama was not vulnerable in the way African American leaders usually are. Obama could not be depicted as threatening, but he was vulnerable to suggestions that he was an outsider and foreign. His middle name was Hussein, and he had spent long stretches of his childhood in other countries. It was the "he's not one of us" message that Powell was worried about. "The primary target is the Reagan Democrats," Powell told me. "People who belong to unions, who in Ohio voted for Democratic Governor Ted Strickland. Strickland won by a huge margin. It helped that his opponent was a black Republican. You don't have to convince them that unions are good or governments have a role, and wouldn't it be great to have health care?" If he lost, Powell concluded about Obama, it would be because people who agreed with Obama on the issues did not want to vote for a black man. It will be because of Democrats. The pollsters, consultants, and psychologists around the table in Chicago decided to devise a series of anti-bias messages and get them out to voters in battleground states. The group wanted to inoculate voters against divisive appeals. They planned to come up with a series of ads to get people to think about the role of race in the election. One would involve shoving an actual elephant into a diner as patrons chewed their food and took nervous glances at the behemoth. As the elephant flapped its ears, a message would say, "Let's talk about the elephant in the room." There was only one time in the 2008 election when the Obama campaign's strategy to neutralize the subject of race came completely undone. It was during the Democratic primary when comments by Obama's pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, surfaced in the national media. Wright had often lashed out at white America in sermons about racial injustice, and Obama's opponents seized on the pastor saying such things as, "Not God bless America, God damn America." The instant Obama found himself linked to Wright's inflammatory comments, his campaign stalled. Reporters later dug up comments made by John C. Hagee, a pastor whom John McCain had embraced, who once said the Holocaust was God's plan to drive Jews to Palestine. And Larry Croon, a pastor of Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin, had said that God would strike the United States of America. On the same day as that first presidential debate, the Washington Post noted that, in the fine, new American tradition of presidential campaign pastor disasters, Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin might have one. It made intuitive sense that if Obama got into a heap of trouble because of his pastor's views, the same thing would happen to McCain and Palin. But that did not happen. And the people in room 2020 of the O'Hare Hilton could have told you why. The real issue with Wright was not his militant and overheated comments, but that contact with Wright unconsciously linked Obama to a notion toxic to many white voters: the angry black man who sought to make whites feel guilty about racism. There was no analogous identity archetype that Hagee and Croon evoked, certainly nothing to rival the deep fears and anxieties that the angry black man conjured. It made sense that the McCain and Palin pastor controversies would sink like stones. I found it interesting that even as the national media wrapped itself into pretzels about Wright's comments, many people of color found Wright utterly unremarkable. Before he parted ways with Wright, Obama himself said he felt his church was not particularly controversial. Wright was certainly inflammatory and given to rhetorical excess, but this partly had to do with the theatricality of sermons in general and the style of the black church in particular. Obama once said Wright is like an old uncle who says things I don't always agree with. But if Wright had a tendency toward overblown rhetoric, most blacks had little problem with the emotional truth of his message. African Americans are 447% more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned, and 521% more likely to be murdered. There is a 5-to-1 wealth gap between whites and blacks at birth. Blacks live 5 years fewer on average than whites, and the black infant mortality rate is nearly 1.5 times the white infant mortality rate. Wouldn't it be odd not to be angry? But once Wright's comments surfaced in the national media, and excerpts from his sermons were replayed endlessly on cable television, it was no longer possible for the Obama campaign to sell its "We are all Americans first" message. The America that Wright described felt like a cruel caricature to many whites. Which version of reality, Obama's opponents asked, did the candidate endorse? Hillary Clinton sat down for a lengthy interview with Bill O'Reilly of Fox News and agreed with the conservative commentator that Obama had some explaining to do. Where the country had seen in Obama only a quiet, well-spoken, Harvard-educated lawyer, the Wright episode raised questions about whether Obama was secretly the kind of militant black activist that many whites abhorred. Obama's first instinct was to let things blow over, but Wright, who could be described as Obama's friend in only the loosest sense of the term, held a televised meeting at the National Press Club in Washington, where he fought back against his critics, argued that they were motivated by racism, and charged that the attacks on him were attacks on the entire black community. Wright addressed his comments to a crowd of supporters, and they gave him a standing ovation. The press conference put Obama in an even more difficult bind. Shortly afterward, Obama renounced his ties with Wright and then did something he almost never did before or after in the 2008 campaign. He explicitly talked about race. In a now famous speech in Philadelphia, Obama presented a picture of race relations very different from that presented by his former pastor. He played conciliator and explained to white people why black people were often angry, and explained to black people why white people were resentful of being reminded endlessly about the legacy of slavery. The country had come a long way since the days of Jim Crow, Obama reminded his black audience, but the country also had a long way still to go. The speech was psychologically astute, and precisely what a psychologist who studies the hidden brain would have recommended. The researchers Richard P. Eibach and Joyce Erlinger have shown that a central reason whites and blacks in America have very different impressions about the state of racial progress is that whites unconsciously compare the state of race relations with the past. Compared to the days of slavery, the country has made enormous strides in race relations, and many whites find it incomprehensible that blacks do not regularly acknowledge the progress that has been made. Eibach and Erlinger found that blacks, on the other hand, unconsciously compare the status quo with an idealized future where discrimination does not exist. For the young black man or woman who suffers subtle forms of discrimination in the workplace, it isn't much consolation to say things were worse 200 years ago. From this perspective, many blacks cannot understand why whites would downplay the reality of their everyday experience. Each side had a point, Obama effectively told his audience, and each side had more in common with the other than either believed. Without overtly looking like he was doing so, Obama also reminded white voters that he was half white. "I can no more disown him than I can my white grandmother," Obama said about his former pastor. The speech was made at the National Constitution Center, and Obama used the occasion to draw the country's attention to the document that bound the nation together. Rather than speak on behalf of any group, Obama spoke on behalf of everyone. The Philadelphia speech was a huge political success, and it revived the Obama campaign. Obama never seriously addressed the subject of race again, and in fact took great pains to avoid the subject altogether. For all the historic significance of an African-American man reaching for the presidency, one of the ironies of the Obama campaign is that it was largely mute when it came to the subject of race. At the Democratic National Convention in Denver, which was held on the 45th anniversary of the famous 1963 March on Washington, with an African-American man on the presidential ticket of a major party for the first time in history, John Powell pointed out to me, with some bitterness, that Obama never mentioned the words race, Martin Luther King, or civil rights in his acceptance speech. The documentary shown about his life, Powell added, was heavy on white people. It emphasized his mother's side of the family, his white side, far more than it did his father's side, even though in his book, Dreams from My Father, Obama emphasized how important it was for him to find his identity as a black man in order to become a leader. Powell told me, and remember, this was a man who was working 18 to 19 hours a day to get Obama elected, that he found the Philadelphia speech politically brilliant, but historically problematic. Rather than talk about the problem of race in America, Obama had talked about the problem of anger in America. Whites were angry with blacks. Blacks were angry with whites. If everyone renounced their anger, we would all be better off. But Powell could not abide the idea that black anger and white anger were equivalent and somehow cancelled each other out. If blacks were angry about slavery and segregation, discrimination and a lack of opportunities, whites were angry because they felt undeserving blacks were taking advantage of the system. Dr. King, in his most important speeches, talked about the importance of righteous indignation, Powell told me. Obama understands that he is playing to a white audience. If he can be Tiger Woods and a non-threatening black, he thinks he can get the support of white people. Two undercurrents of discomfort ran beneath the table at the secret Chicago meeting. One had to do with the conflicting challenges of fighting bias and fighting to win an election. The people around the table knew that if they were against bias, they also had to be against the ageism and sexism that prompted voters to feel McCain was too old and that Sarah Palin was yet another incompetent woman. By the end of the meeting, Powell said the goal was less about getting Obama elected and more about removing bias from the equation. As long as voters did not reject a candidate because of bias, it was perfectly legitimate to vote for or against anyone. But there was another undercurrent that ran still deeper. When you found unconscious bias, there were two things you could do about it. You could fight it at an implicit level, as the Obama campaign was doing. Without ever making a fuss about racism, you could project counter-stereotypical messages that radiated calm and reassurance. The other approach was explicit. You called out voters who agreed with your candidate on the issues but were reluctant to vote for him because of racism. This would be the Martin Luther King Jr. way, the path of righteous indignation. The trouble was, calling people out on racism made them defensive. Even if you won the argument, you could lose their vote. The Obama approach was much more astute politically, but there was something disturbing about it. If the only way for a black politician to be acceptable to whites was to project an image of a non-threatening black man, the exception to the rule, wasn't that implicitly an endorsement of the stereotype? These concerns would be amplified as the group designed a series of ads and tested them among a large number of undecided white voters in battleground states. Celinda Lake ran the ads by 500 men and 500 women with blue-collar backgrounds, the people who told white pollsters one thing and black pollsters something else. Lake asked the voters what they made of each ad and how it made them feel. The psychologist, Drew Weston, measured how the ads changed unconscious attitudes toward Obama. The Elephant in the Room ad was an example of how bias might be combated explicitly. Another ad targeted the hidden brain. It involved a blue-collar worker speaking directly into the camera. One version featured a man, another a woman. The speaker articulated many of the concerns about Obama that were being circulated in white working-class communities, that Obama would give preference to black people, and that he was an unpatriotic outsider. The idea, said Weston, was to openly acknowledge what people were feeling. But rather than dismiss such concerns as racist or wrong, as the union leader Richard Trumka had done with his old friend in Nemacolin, Pennsylvania, the ad gave people an alternative way to think about their feelings. This was the text of the ad featuring a 50-ish white woman. The woman was identified as Sue Burton of Zanesville, Ohio. A lot of people aren't quite sure about Barack Obama. He seems steady. He talks about things that matter to me, the price of gas and groceries, and healthcare we can count on. But then sometimes I get that feeling, you know, uneasy. I'm not really sure who he is. Does he really love his country? Maybe if he gets elected, he's going to put the interests of black people above the interests of the rest of us. You know, I was talking with my mom about it. She and Dad had the same questions about President Kennedy before he was elected. They had that same feeling, uneasy. Maybe he'd put his Catholic faith before his country. I'm not prejudiced. I just want to know that he shares my values and cares about people like me. And I think he does. I think he loves his two little girls just like I love mine. I think he loves our country just like I do. It hasn't been easy for me, but I'm going to give him a chance. I am an American, and so is he. The conventional way to counter an untruth is to confront it. Indeed, if you subscribe to the notion that people's conscious minds are all that matter, this is what you should do. Good information ought to drive bad information out of circulation. It's only when you think about politics with the hidden brain in mind that you understand why innumerable fact-checking websites and media articles ahead of the 2008 presidential election did little to prevent millions of Americans from believing blatant falsehoods about Obama. The "I Am an American" ad took a different tack. It set aside the conscious mind altogether and focused entirely on the hidden brain. Rather than tell people that the allegations against Obama were false, the ad took the point of view of people who felt uneasy. It was an old lesson from therapy textbooks. Regardless of whether feelings were justified, they were real. You cannot eliminate feelings by denying their validity. Indeed, denying them usually strengthened them. The "I Am an American" ad did not present refutations to the woman's beliefs or try to show that her feelings were unjustified or wrong. Rather, it was the woman herself who made the emotional decision to override her fears. She wasn't being corrected. She was being courageous. The message tested well in focus groups, but some funders, Weston told me, were uncomfortable about a message that did not explicitly refute untrue insinuations about Obama. The notion of setting aside the conscious mind and focusing only on the hidden brain can be difficult to swallow. But if you refute it, it has a different meaning, Weston said. My conscious concern about the refutation is it sounds contrived. This does not sound like a person who has struggled with this. It sounds like an Obama campaign worker. The experts tested a number of other approaches. One ad called Team USA showed a girls' soccer match in progress with the soundtrack of America the Beautiful in the background. A series of adorable black and white children played together, intensely focused on the game, with smiles and camaraderie. It then showed a close-up shot of Joe Jacoby, a white Olympic gold medal winner in whitewater canoeing, followed by a shot of a black woman, Teresa Edwards, a four-time Olympic gold medal winner in basketball. The ad then cut to an amateur men's basketball game, with players of all races engaged in intense teamwork. The ball swished through the basket, and the ad zoomed in on a black hand and a white palm, low-fiving, in an acknowledgement of interdependence. A message on the screen read, "We're all on the same team. Team USA. Whereas the ad with the elephant in the diner was designed to make people think and perhaps make them feel uncomfortable, Weston told me the Team USA ad followed the model of the Obama campaign to go for the lump in the throat. People wanted to feel good about themselves. And calling them to their better natures did this, just as calling them racists made them angry and defensive. The Team USA ad reinforced the racially inclusive impulses of voters. In another ad, the camera cut seamlessly between two families, one white, one black. In both cases, the family sat on a couch in identical positions, one child on the mum's lap while a little girl sat on her dad's lap. Both dads read aloud from the children's book, The Little Engine That Could. White Dad. The very little engine looked up and saw the tears in the doll's eyes, and she thought of the good little boys and girls on the other side of the mountain. Black Dad. Who would not have any toys or good food unless she helped, and then she said, I think I can. White Dad. I think I can, I think I can. Black Dad. And she hitched herself to the little train and the little blue engine smiled. White Dad. And seemed to say, as she puffed steadily down the mountain, Black Dad. I thought I could, I thought I could. White Dad. I thought I could, I thought I could. Black Dad. I thought I could. It is only a different voice and a different family, but they are sitting exactly the same way and doing exactly the same thing, Weston told me, shortly after he finished supervising the shooting of the ad with the black family. The soundtrack to that is going to be a light piano or a female voice humming Amazing Grace, and the only words that come up on the screen are, We are all God's children. That is calling people to their better angels, to what their faith teaches them. Weston thought the ad was especially effective because research showed that whites were drawn to images of black parents reading to their children, a message counter to the idea of disintegrated black families and disinterested black fathers. When you pair hard work with black, you deactivate the stereotypes that make race so toxic. And when you add paternal responsibility to black dads, you do the same thing, Weston told me. This is why people resonate to Cosby and Obama talking about taking responsibility for their children and father absence being a disaster in the inner cities. You turn down the volume on one of the ways covert racism expresses itself. The voters who participated in testing the ads were men older than 30 and women older than 50 who had not completed college. The results revealed how unconscious attitudes diverged from conscious attitudes. Take the All God's Children ad with the black and white dads reading to their children. Weston shot and tested two versions of the ad. One had the black and white dads, and another featured a white family and two different black families, with one of the black dads darker than the other. In this second version of the ad, all the dads again read from The Little Engine That Could, and the cuts went seamlessly among the families. This ad, with two black families and one white family, scored very high in terms of voters' conscious responses. People really responded consciously to the idea of the black dads and the white dad reading the same children's book to their families in different homes. But Weston found that the ad had zero effect on people's unconscious attitudes toward Obama. The ad with a white family and just one black family, featuring the lighter-skinned black dad, generated less positive approval from voters at a conscious level, but was far more effective at an unconscious level in changing people's willingness to support Obama. Without their awareness, something about the darker-skinned black dad rubbed voters the wrong way. Their conscious minds may have known we are all God's children. Their unconscious minds did not agree. The I Am an American ads, with the blue-collar workers speaking directly into the camera about concerns that Obama was an outsider who would harm the interests of white people, scored moderately well at the conscious level, but they were highly effective at the level of unconscious attitudes. The ad showing the female worker articulating her doubts and reaching an internal resolution was the most successful of all the ads that Weston and his group created.